It was not easy to earn money in the Glen, but Jim went at it determinedly. He made tops out of old reels for the boys in school for 2 cents apiece. He sold 3 treasured milk teeth for 3 cents. He sold his slice of apple crunch pie every Saturday afternoon to Bertie Shakespeare Drew. Every night he put what he had earned into the little brass pig Nan had given him for Christmas. Such a nice, shiny brass pig with a slit in his back wherein to drop coins. When you had put in 50 coppers, the pig would open neatly of his own accord if you twisted his tail and yield you back your wealth. Finally, to make up the last 8 cents, he sold his string of bird's eggs to Mac Reese. It was the finest string in the Glen, and it hurt a little to let it go. But the birthday was drawing near, and the money must be come by. Jim dropped the 8 cents into the pig as soon as Mac had paid him, and he gloated over it. "Twist his tail and see if he really will open up," said Mac, who didn't believe he would. But Jim refused. He was not going to open it until he was ready to go for the necklace. The missionary auxiliary met at Ingleside the next afternoon and never forgot it. Right in the middle of Mrs. Norman Taylor's prayer, and Mrs. Norman Taylor was credited with being very proud of her prayers, a frantic small boy burst into the living room. "My brass pig's gone, Mother! My brass pig's gone!" Anne hustled him out, but Mrs. Norman always considered that her prayer was spoiled, and as she had especially wanted to impress a visiting minister's wife, it was long years before she forgave Jim or would have his father as a doctor again. After the ladies had gone home, Ingleside was ransacked from top to bottom for the pig, without result. Jim, between the scolding he had got for his behavior and his anguish over his loss, could remember just when he had seen it last or where. Mac Reese, telephoned to, responded that the last he had seen of the pig, it was standing on Jim's bureau. "You don't suppose, Susan, that Mac Reese..." "No, Mrs. Doctor, dear, I feel quite sure he didn't. The Reeses have their faults, terrible keen after the money they are, but it has to be honestly come by. Where can that blessed pig be?" "Maybe the rats at it," said Di. Jim scoffed at the idea, but it worried him. Of course rats couldn't eat a brass pig with 50 coppers inside of him. But could they? "No, no, dear, your pig will turn up," assured Mother. It hadn't turned up when Jim went to school the next day. News of his loss had reached school before him, and many things were said to him, not exactly comforting. But at recess, Sissy Flagg sidled up to him ingratiatingly. Sissy Flagg liked Jim, and Jim did not like her. In spite of, or perhaps because of, her thick yellow curls and huge brown eyes. Even at 8, one may have problems concerning the opposite sex. "I can tell you who's got your pig."
"Who?"
"You've got to pick me for clap in and clap out, and I'll tell you." It was a bitter pill, but Jim swallowed it. Anything to find that pig. He sat in an agony of blushes beside the triumphant Sissy while they clapped in and clapped out, and when the bell rang, he demanded his reward. "Alice Palmer says Willie Drew told her Bob Russell told him Fred Elliott said he knew where your pig was. Go and ask Fred."
"Cheat!" cried Jim, glaring at her. "Cheat!"
Sissy laughed arrogantly. She didn't care. Jim Blythe had had to sit with her for once, anyhow. Jim went to Fred Elliott, who at first declared he knew nothing about the old pig and didn't want to. Jim was in despair. Fred Elliott was 3 years older than he was and a noted bully. Suddenly, he had an inspiration. He pointed a grimy forefinger sternly at big, red-faced Fred Elliott.
"You are a transubstantiationalist," he said distinctly.
"Here, you, don't you call me names, young Blythe."
"That is more than a name," said Jim. "That is a hoodoo word. If I say it again and point my finger at you, so, you may have bad luck for a week. Maybe your toes will drop off. I'll count 10, and if you haven't told me before I get to 10, I'll hoodoo you."
Fred didn't believe it, but the skating race came off that night, and he wasn't taking chances. Besides, toes were toes. At 6, he surrendered.
"All right, all right. Don't bust your jaws saying that a second time."
Mac knows where your pig is. He said he did.
Mac was not in school, but when Anne heard Jim's story, she telephoned his mother. Mrs. Reese came up a little later, flushed and apologetic. Mac didn't take the pig, Mrs. Blythe. He just wanted to see if it would open, so when Jim was out of the room, he twisted the tail. It fell apart in two pieces, and he couldn't get it together again, so he put the two halves of the pig and the money in one of Jim's Sunday boots in the closet. He hadn't ought to have touched it, and his father has wailed the stuffing out of him. But he didn't steal it, Mrs. Blythe.
What was that word you said to Fred Elliot, little Jim dear? Asked Susan, when the dismembered pig had been found and the money counted.
Transubstantiationalist, said Jim proudly. Walter found it in the dictionary last week. You know he likes great big full words, Susan.
And we both learned how to pronounce it.
We said it over to each other 21 times in bed before we went to sleep so that we'd remember it.
Now that the necklace was bought and stowed away in the third box from the top in the middle drawer of Susan's bureau, Susan having been privy to the plan all along, Jim thought the birthday would never come. He gloated over his unconscious mother. Little she knew what was hidden in Susan's bureau drawer. Little she knew what her birthday would bring her. Little she knew when she sang the twins to sleep with, I saw a ship a-sailing on the sea, and oh, it was all laden with pretty things for me, what the ship would bring her. Gilbert had an attack of influenza in early March, which almost ran to pneumonia. Anne went about as usual, smoothing out tangles, administering consolation, bending over moonlit beds to see if dear little bodies were warm, but the children missed her laughter.
What will the world do if Father dies? Whispered Walter, white-lipped.
He isn't going to die, darling. He is out of danger now. Anne wondered herself what their small world of four winds and the glens and the harbor head would do if anything had happened to Gilbert. They were all coming to depend on him so. The Upper Glen people especially seemed really to believe that he could raise the dead and only refrain because it would be crossing the purposes of the Almighty. He had done it once, they averred. Old Uncle Archibald MacGregor had solemnly assured Susan that Samuel Hewitt was dead as a doornail when Dr. Blythe brought him to. However that might be, when living people saw Gilbert's lean brown face and friendly hazel eyes by their bedside and heard his cheery, "Why, there's nothing the matter with you," well, they believed it until it came true. As for namesakes, he had more than he could count. The whole Four Winds district was peppered with young Gilberts. There was even a tiny Gilbertine. So Dad was about again, and Mother was laughing again, and at last it was the night before the birthday.
If you go to bed early, little Jim, tomorrow will come quicker, assured Susan.
Jim tried it, but it didn't seem to work. Walter fell asleep promptly, but Jim squirmed about. He was afraid to go to sleep. Suppose he didn't waken in time, and everybody else had given their presents to Mother. He wanted to be the very first. Why hadn't he asked Susan to be sure and call him? She had gone out to make a visit somewhere, but he would ask her when she came in. If he were sure of hearing her, well, he'd just go down and lie on the living room sofa, and then he couldn't miss her. Jim crept down and curled up on the Chesterfield. He could see over the glen. The moon was filling the hollows among the white, snowy dunes with magic. The great trees that were so mysterious at night held out their arms about Ingleside. He heard all the night sounds of a house, a floor creaking, someone turning in bed, the crumble and fall of coals in the fireplace, the scurrying of a little mouse in the china closet. Was that an avalanche? No, only snow sliding off the roof. It was a little lonesome. Why didn't Susan come? If he only had Jip now. Dear Jippy. Had he forgotten Jip? No, not forgotten exactly. But it didn't hurt so much now to think of him. One did think of other things a good deal of the time. Sleep well, dearest of dogs. Perhaps sometime he would have another dog after all. It would be nice if he had one right now. Or Shrimp. But the Shrimp wasn't round. Selfish old cat, thinking of nothing but his own affairs. No sign of Susan yet coming along the long road that wound endlessly on through that strange white moonlit distance that was his own familiar glen in daytime. Well, he would just have to imagine things to pass the time. Someday he would go to Baffin Land and live with Eskimos. Someday he would sail to far seas and cook a shark for Christmas dinner like Captain Jim. He would go on an expedition to the Congo in search of gorillas. He would be a diver and wander through radiant crystal halls under the sea. He would get Uncle Davy to teach him how to milk into the cat's mouth the next time he went up to Avonlea. Uncle Davy did that so expertly. Perhaps he would be a pirate. Susan wanted him to be a minister. The minister could do the most good, but wouldn't a pirate have the most fun? Suppose the little wooden soldier hopped off the mantelpiece and shot off his gun. Suppose the chairs began walking about the room. Suppose the tiger rug came alive. Suppose the quack bees, which he and Walter pretended all over the house when they were very young, really were about. Jim was suddenly frightened. In daytime, he did not often forget the difference between romance and reality, but it was different in this endless night. Tick-tack went the clock, tick-tack, and for every tick there was a quack bear sitting on a step of the stairs. The stairs were just black with quack bears. They would sit there till daylight, gibbering. Suppose God forgot to let the sun rise. The thought was so terrible that Jim buried his face in the afghan to shut it out. And there Susan found him sound asleep when she came home in the fiery orange of a winter sunrise.
Little Jim!
Jim uncoiled himself and sat up yawning. It had been a busy night for Silvermith Frost, and the woods were fairyland. A far-off hill was touched with a crimson spear. All the white fields beyond the glen were a lovely rose color. It was Mother's birthday morning.
I was waiting for you, Susan, to tell you to call me, and you never came.
I went down to see the John Warrens because their aunt had died, and they asked me to stay and sit up with the corpse, explained Susan cheerfully. I didn't suppose you'd be trying to catch pneumonia, too, the minute my back was turned. Scamper off to your bed, and I'll call you when I hear your mother stirring.
Susan, how do you stab sharks?
Jem wanted to know before he went upstairs.
I do not stab them, answered Susan.
Mother was up when he went into her room, brushing her long, shining hair before the glass. Her eyes when she saw the necklace.
Jem, darling, for me.
Now you won't have to wait till Dad's ship comes in, said Jim with a fine nonchalance. What was that gleaming greenly on Mother's hand?
A ring.
Dad's present. All very well, but rings were common things. Even Sissy Flagg had one. But a pearl necklace.
A necklace is such a nice birthday-ish thing, said Mother.